Welcome, everybody. Hey, it is Saturday morning. It is the 17th of July, and I'm Eileen Grimes, astrologer, and with me today is Mr. Michelangelo. He is from New York City. He's our regular guest when we have a special musical person that is on not online, actually, but, you know, in spirit. But today we are doing Maurice Ravel, who wrote the Bolero piece, you know, and that was his most famous piece, I found out. I did a whole thing of research yesterday. I have 10 pages of notes, Michelangelo. Isn't that something?
Way ahead of me. I am too, but
man, what a life, you know. Whew. Anyway, so we're going to be talking a lot about him and his chart coming up, and we'll give the data, and we're going to be doing him as the celebrity of the week too, so that's usually how we do it. But Michelangelo and I are going to be talking about his life and his compositions and just about everything that happened to him, and we'll look at it through the astrological lens, which will be fascinating. And his life is pretty fascinating when you get right down to it. There's comments. I don't know. He hasn't heard them yet. Michelangelo hasn't heard them. But I have some theories about him. So we'll be talking about them in a little bit. So anyway, and let's see. Do we have anything else on today? No, I don't think we have anything else out today. Okay. So, so we're going to do that right after the break. And we're going to be talking about him for the full hour. So we're not going to take any phone calls, but we might in the future. Who knows? You know, evidently that one when we had on Donna Sebo a couple weeks ago, we were flat, just, you know, completely smashed with phone calls. So it was really great. So people are listening, and I'm really happy that they are. And you, if you are listening, thank you so much for doing that, because we really do appreciate that so much. So anyway, right after the break, we're going to be talking about Senior Ravel. It's not senior, it's Monsieur Ravel. Thank you, he's French. Anyway, so this is the Jupiter Rising Show right here on KKNW, Alternative Talk Radio.
Alternative Talk 1150. We're on your radio at 1150 AM. We're on your HD radio at 98.9 Channel 3.
So many ways to listen.
We're on the web at 1150kknw.com. Streaming live audio and video, as well as MP3 archives of many of our shows.
So many ways to listen.
And now, we're on your smartphone or tablet. Download our free app in the Apple App Store or Google Play and take Alternative Talk 1150 anywhere you go.
So many ways to listen.
Alternative Talk 1150, local talk for the body, mind, and soul.
Wow. I mean, I haven't really listened to all these pieces all the way through. That is a bunch of moods stuck together. Wouldn't you say that, Michelangelo? Wow.
Oh, yeah, most assuredly, yeah.
Wow.
So it's a really very attractive piano concerto that he wrote.
It's beautiful. It's wonderful. Yeah. I mean, he starts off one, then he starts in another, and then he does another, and he's another. Wow. I mean, he's very eclectic, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very eclectic. Okay, yeah, so
I don't know if you listened a little further on, but there's a decided echo of something that sounds a bit like George Gershwin, and Ravel became very interested in jazz as he matured in his career. You know,
I should listen to the rest of it, because we don't know that George Gershwin asked him to teach him.
Yes, that's right.
That's
absolutely
right. So I can see why he would do that. Actually, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So,
Ravel was certainly one of the master orchestrators of the 20th century, maybe the greatest after Rimsky-Korsakov, you know.
Right.
And you can hear it in his compositions.
It's I tell you, just brilliantly out there, just right between the eyes. Okay, so let me give you his birth data, everybody. Okay, he was born March 7th, 1875, at 10 p.m. And basically, I use Biarritz, France, because the other city wasn't listed, which was, what was it? Something. You remember the?
I've got Saint-Jean-de-Luz here.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah.
The degree of the ascendant is 4 degrees, Scorpio.
Yeah, it's the same.
Okay,
yes,
so we got the same chart. All righty. Thank goodness. You don't want to be on two different pages here. Okay, so let's talk about his chart a little bit. After kind of digesting, I spent most of the day yesterday reading on Wikipedia his bio and everything else involved with it. Man, what an interesting life. It's just kind of bounced all over the place, didn't he?
Yeah. And it's certainly a chart that I think presents with a lot of outstanding features.
Yes. Let's list some of them.
Well, the first one, of course, is Uranus right at the top.
I mean,
that's really
That's the first thing I noticed.
We don't really think of Ravel so much as a revolutionary in the same way as we would Debussy, although they sort of lumped them both in the same camp.
Right.
Neither of which were terribly happy about that, I think. But so it one of the things that I came across, and maybe you did too, is his early embrace of recording technology, which was certainly be innovative.
He was the first one to record, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, certainly one of the earlier ones, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's quite fascinating. And of course, there's this, again, we have to say that even if he isn't an innovator in the same way that Debussy is, because Debussy, I think, in many ways was really a musical anarchist of a different sort than, say, Wagner, who sort of blew everything up in his way. But
That's true. Yeah.
But, you know, he still had a very idiosyncratic genius, Ravel, which is, I think, really something that people early on recognized some of it, but I think it's only really latterly that people really began to understand the unique gifts that he had.
Yes, and it took him quite a while to really sink his feet in and get going, basically. I think it was about the 20s where his music started to get quite popular.
Yeah, and of course we could probably attribute some of that to our dear friend Mercury retrograde, right?
Oh, we could. The delay in having
it. Yeah, the delay of that.
There was one thing I wrote down here in my notes, and you probably find this interesting, but it was something that was so obvious to me after listening to the timing of all these things and when they played out. That and I haven't listened to all of his music that much, but, you know, he and Art Deco seem to float together really well.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, because art, you know, any art form that's whether it's artistic or it's music will kind of, they'll coincide with each other and reflect each other during the time period that they're in, you know. Yeah. And I was thinking 1920 into the 20s, he started to gain a lot of popularity. I said, well, that's right in the height of Art Deco movement, you know.
Yeah.
And some of his music actually sounds like that, you know, that how you would visualize or how you would hear that particular music being played through an Art Deco form.
I can definitely hear that and see that. Absolutely.
Yeah, I could hear it in the last piece. You know, I really could. So I wrote that down as a big, huge thing because I thought, well, we might come back to that because it was something, and, you know, he's going to be under the influence of many things, you know, during the time he was alive, you know, the social environment, everything. And how everything, you know, the people that were, what kind of music they were listening to at that time, you know, so that type of thing kind of wove its way into his music, it seems like.
Oh, I mean, a tremendous ferment in classical music between 1875 and let's just say arbitrarily 1930, you know, I mean, just so many innovations, so many remarkable composers, you know, born and produce these extraordinary works. We could talk about Stravinsky, we could talk about Debussy, we could talk about, I mean,
absolutely.
And we have the waning years, obviously, in the early 1970s of Verdi and Wagner, you know, so that influence still persists, you know, at least until the latter half of, you know, the latter bit of the 19th century. And all of this sort of drunk in, you know, as part of his musical education.
Yeah, let's look at his chart a bit. His chart's interesting.
Sure. Well, I just wanted to comment a little further on the Uranus, the elevated Uranus, was that, of course, his father was an engineer and apparently a fairly successful inventor.
Yes.
And Ravel sort of, in an interesting way, inherited those proclivities, you know, although he curiously throughout his own life, and maybe again, this is the Mercury retrograde speaking, he had a peculiar lack of dexterity at certain kinds of ordinary tasks. But the most intricate, you know, sort of, I read something just a little while ago, but you probably saw it too, that he made these little sculptures in bread, apparently, you know, that he had this. So he was almost like a Swiss watchmaker person was made. So I think that we could also associate that with that very powerful Uranus at the midheaven.
Yeah. And also with Mercury retrograde, it's Mercury's in Pisces. Now, you would not expect it to act in the way it would act, like somebody like a Mercury in Virgo. But that's kind of what his brain turned out to be. He was very meticulous about what he did. Hyper-meticulous.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wrote pieces, he wrote them for the piano, and then he orchestrated them, usually. Is that what he did?
Yeah. He did definitely, you know, capitalized on the fact that he could take a piece like the Pavane for a Dead Princess, which I hope we're going to listen to.
Yeah, we're going to listen to that here.
and turn it into just this beautiful orchestral version. You know, just remarkable how he was able to translate his you know, very interesting piano pieces into even more striking orchestral renditions.
Yeah, it seems like it was like his homework to do the written out piece first, you know, and then to transpose it for orchestra. I mean, that was sort of like, you know, it's sort of like doing the outline for a book when you're writing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's a way that, you know, many composers will proceed. You know, a composer writes an opera, they obviously don't write the full orchestral score, usually. And Puccini certainly never did. He sketched out everything on the piano and orchestrated it later.
Oh, well.
So it is a fairly common way of proceeding, but nevertheless, the capacity to mine these pieces and bring them to a wider audience through, you know, I think there's an immediate appeal to an extraordinarily successfully orchestrated work that maybe a piano piece doesn't have as quite a big a draw.
You know? Right, exactly. Yeah. And he must have been felt driven to do it too. I mean, he was quite obsessive about doing the right thing when, you know, and making sure it's perfect, you know, and that's Mercury in Pisces. No, that's not really Mercury in Pisces, but it is retrograde. So
it does square Mars. So he's got that.
Okay. The drive.
You know, that impetus there. And of course, Mars in Sagittarius.
Yeah.
Of course, that elevated Uranus made him extremely independent in many, many ways.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yes. That's for sure. You know,
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
With the new moon also in Pisces.
Yes, that's true.
You know, that innovative and independent streak seemed to be. Yeah. The other interesting thing, too, is that he really was indifferent to what people thought about
him. Yeah, that's right. He didn't really care.
Yeah.
He didn't. He sort of knew what he was definitely, you know, on the right track for himself. He took a different road, obviously. You know, he went down road, then he went, "Oop, I'm taking that one, I'm not taking this one. You know, that's not right for me." You know, so anytime I see a double Pisces, you know, sun and moon, you know that the creative function is going to be really well developed, you know.
Yeah, and the big three, of course, all in water.
That's true. Ah, yes. Sun, moon, and rising sign. Yeah. Scorpio rising. You know, the interesting, they were talking about his personal life.
Yeah.
And they said they really didn't know much about his personal life. He was a mystery. But he did go to brothels. And he didn't have that, you know. And the Scorpio rising would obviously give him a real sense of, oh, I got to take a break, don't I? Hello, I'm going to talk all day without taking a break.
Just go ahead and finish that comment, then we can go to break.
Okay. So anyway, you know, with the Scorpio, you know, Scorpio rising, everybody's going to notice it. It's going to be right out there in front of people. And I remember looking at the pictures of him. I thought it was pretty cute, you know.
Very elegant, very dapper.
Very, very elegant. But, you know, he had...
Tiny man.
And now that's the interesting... That's part of the Uranus thing, you know. Everything went together except for his height. You know, there's one thing that stood out as being different. You know, so he's quite. How tall was he?
Well, I'd have to check, but I think probably.
It's like,
you know,
I don't remember. Maybe it was 5'4" or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Pretty short.
Pretty darn short, yeah. So, I mean.
5'3", yep.
5'3"?
Oh, there we go.
Oh, thank you.
Wow, that's really short.
That's really short. Yeah, that's. That's what it says. Cool. Well, thank you, Nathan. That was good to get that. Okay. So anyway, we're going to take a break really quick right now. It's fun talking about this guy because he's a very, very unique guy. So let's go to the break and we'll be right back here with the Jupiter Rising Show right here on KKNW Alternative Talk Radio.
This is Martha Norwalk, every Sunday morning beginning at 9 a.m. Thanks in part to Nels Rasmussen at SpiritualPetConnection.com, we cover the world of animals. This week, July 18th, it's Behavior Training and Healing Sunday with me, and talk with your human or animal friends on this side or the other, and personal awareness coaching with Natasha Venter. We'll have open phone lines for your calls, so hope you can join us and plan to call in. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Alternative Talk 1150, talk radio for the body, mind, and soul.
Wow, I was getting lost in that one. That is just beautiful. That is the suite number 2 from Daphnis and Chloe. And That just reminds me so much of Holst for some reason. I don't know why.
Well, similar kind of impetus.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of around the same time, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're more or less contemporaries.
Yeah.
Of course, notably, Vaughan Williams, who's Holst's great friend throughout his life, actually studied with Ravel, one of
That's
the few
right.
pupils that Ravel actually sort of deigned to take on because he was so afraid, as with Gershwin, as I'm sure you probably read, Eileen, that he was afraid that Gershwin would just turn into a Ravel imitation. And so
yes,
he discouraged Gershwin
that.
From studying
yeah.
with him. But yeah. Vaughan Williams, maybe because he was of, you know, the English school and he was particularly, you know, involved with the collection of folk song, his muse arguably probably wouldn't have been as susceptible, for want of a better term,
okay.
to the Gallic influence of Ravel.
That's just
but you can certainly hear it in Vaughan Williams' later compositions, how influenced he was by Ravel's orchestration.
Yeah, this is an impressionistic. This is right around late 1800s, early 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
This is the impression.
Although Ravel probably would have bridled at the term impressionism.
Yes, he would have. That's right. That's what he said in the, you know, he wouldn't like that much.
Yeah. No,
so I remember reading that. Yeah. So I wonder
Daphnis and Chloe, which we just heard. I mean, to me, that opening section of Daphnis and Chloe is just sublime.
That's,
you know,
just,
I mean,
gorgeous.
Absolutely. Yeah. And arguably people say maybe his greatest work. Of the three big ballets that he composed in that short period of time for Sergei Diaghilev. Of course, some people will know that Stravinsky also composed ballets for Diaghilev, most famously The Rite of Spring.
Okay, that's
so,
right.
So Ravel also composed these ballets, but that suite from Daphnis is definitely a perennial favorite with orchestras worldwide, for sure.
I remember reading that Stravinsky was, I guess, premiering or showing off The Rite of Spring for everybody. And I guess Ravel was the only one that got the music, got it. And nobody else did.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's certainly, that Uranus would make him a forethinker, wouldn't it? I mean, he would really be on the cutting edge. Even though he sort of described himself to a certain extent as a traditionalist, he would recognize that innovative spark.
He certainly would via the mechanism or how he did things. The procedures are very, very traditional, but his music is certainly not traditional at all.
No.
And the interesting thing, I'm looking at Uranus at the midheaven, and it's also ruling the fourth house cusp. So he has the influence of both Aquarius on both parents. So, his mother was evidently, what was it, illiterate? Something else?
Reportedly,
And she was
illegitimate. There's
and that's right, yes. So that's an unusual situation right there. But his father, being an inventor and all that kind of stuff, really gave him a perspective that was very unique about his parents and what the things would have been appropriate or the things that he would want to do to stand out, so his parents would probably accept him and revere him, would be to do things very differently, you know.
Yeah,
and he pretty much did his whole life.
There's a strong independent streak. As I said, this whole idea of this studied indifference to what people thought, you know, just following his own individual lodestar, whatever that was.
The interesting thing, but when he went to the Paris Conservatoire of music, he was thrown out three times.
Yeah, isn't that something? I mean, speaking as someone who, I don't have Uranus at the midheaven, but it does trine the midheaven, who was thrown out of at least one school myself.
Yeah,
I can certainly understand how that could have happened, because he really was an indifferent student. You know, he only really wanted to learn what he wanted to learn. And again, you could see how that. It's amazing how people will take against you if they perceive something that they secretly wish they had.
That's probably true, you know, because in the closet, a lot of these people were that really liked him. They didn't really show it, but the people that really liked him were very important people.
So
Fauré,
notably.
Yes, Fauré for sure. And some degree Debussy, but not that much. But,
no, just a little. Again, some Debussy and influence some people have detected, but I would say only early on, probably.
Yeah, I can hear it a little bit, but not that much. Yeah. But I'd still be interested to see the connection to Holst, because I kept hearing the tonality of Holst going through there too.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And so it would, he would have been just kind of crazy, seems like, to a lot of people, like an alien that dropped in from a different planet, you know, and had different, you know.
Yeah, you know, I think you can see that, absolutely.
You know, he says, what are you doing? What are you composing? You're not doing it like everybody else's. You've got your own way. He says, well, that's the only way I can do it, you know, basically. Yeah. And not too many people, I mean, people in those days, I mean, these, I shouldn't say this, but people in those days didn't fire themselves up to rebel against positions of authority. They just didn't do that. You know,
no, you're still sort of in that comfy, I mean, what we call it, sort of the twilight years of all the great European empires.
Yeah.
You know, the Edwardian Empire. You know,
it's such an incredibly creative time with all those composers. But also there was a kind of rules that were set up that weren't really set up. Huh? Yeah. Did that make any sense? Yeah. I mean, unspoken rules.
I mean,
rules.
There were a lot of intellectual movements that a lot of these young
people
joined.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
You know, the Scapigliatura in Italy, and there was a similar group in Germany. And they talk here about Ravel, you know, joining this group called Les Apaches, the hooligans, right?
I know.
And literally, in this case, described as artistic outcasts, I'm reading.
Yes.
Uranus. Once again, there's more Uranus, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, I kept reading these things and said, well, I'll just add that to the Uranus pile, right? You know what I mean? It's just so prevalent in his life, you know, that he really did go against so much, you know, and it kind of usually bite him in the shorts after a while, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so finally, though, in about 1920, things started to heat up for him, which is great. Yeah. What I wrote down here somewhere is that it seems as though it would be, for someone like Ravel, the time period would have to adjust to perfectly to him so that he would fit in. It's a reverse thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does that sound what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, we could certainly see that there are a lot of, I mean, I did sort of a little timeline. You probably did as
well.
Oh,
yes. Know, let's take a look at that.
You know, at age 27, progressed lunar return, right? He attends Pelias and Melisande, the premier, and I'm sure you noted, you know, most people didn't know what to make of it, but he was very enthusiastic about Pelias, you know.
Right.
So he's still sort of, I think, finding his way up right up until the Saturn return. And it really, the first big success is at the upper Saturn square, which is often the case with certain types of people. You know, he orchestrated the Pavane for a Dead Princess, which he'd written earlier. But when that was premiered, that orchestral version, he really had the beginnings of his success, because people began to recognize, you know, the unique genius, you know. And then a year later, he has the premiere of his little opera, L'Heure Espagnole, which is very charming.
What is that translated?
The Spanish Hour. And this is this funny joke about this workman who carries in all these clocks, and the lover of the soprano, the tenor, is basically carried inside the clock by this huge hulking workman. So, you know, I mean, it's very charming.
Okay.
Wonderful opera.
That sounds kind of funny, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then by 37, of course, the three ballets, including Daphnis and Chloe. So by after the second upper Saturn square, he seems to arrive.
Okay. Is this after his Saturn return?
Sort of age 35 to age 37.
Okay.
That's
all right. Yeah. I got it.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, you could see the formative influences in place, and that's often the case, you know, with these late bloomers, is everything's there, but for whatever reason, the recognition doesn't come until that upper Saturn square at age 35. Similar with Orson Welles. I'm working on a thing with him. You know, he does Citizen Kane, you know, before his Saturn return, but it's a flop, you know, at the box office.
Right.
It isn't until age 35 that he does a film that's a box office hit. And so fame then arrives in that sense, you know. So, I mean,
well, it seems like
there's interesting parallels.
Seems like the Saturn return would have brought you around to back to yourself and take a look at what you're doing and doing that isn't working, and then change it. And then by the 7 years later, you're having a major thing happen. You know,
absolutely,
that makes sense.
He composed, as I noted here, a few Debussy-like works prior to the Saturn return. So, see, the formative influences are still sort of coming into place. At 30, of course, you have that whole scandal about the Prix de Rome, where he is eliminated, and there's this huge, you know, uproar because he's obviously extremely talented, and it's, you know, purely political. But so there's the setback of Saturn, happening right after the return.
Stepping over the boundaries a little too far, sounds
like. And I think Holst, it was kind of the same way for Holst, too. He really didn't. Hit it big until after his Saturn.
That's right. You know? That's right. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Wow. Okay. We got to take another break right now here. But when we get back, we're going to be actually the next piece we are going to listen to is the Pavane for the Dead Princess. So that's going to be coming up here shortly. So anyway, this is the Jupiter Rising Show right here on KKNW Alternative Talk Radio. And this is a thing, God, I'm starting so well. This is a live read for the Emerald Spiral Fair, which is coming up next Saturday. After almost 2 years, we're coming back on July 24th at Kent Commons. We are the biggest New Age fair in the Northwest, featuring spiritual, metaphysical authors, crystals, and many psychic readers. There are over 60 booths selling crystals, books, and readings. And at least I know there's more booths available, so let me get back to that in a minute. Bring your family, friends, kindred spirits, and explore this exciting world of alternative medicine, New Age wisdom, and quantum physics. Allow the Emerald Spiral Expo to help you discover a new adventure on your journey of spirituality, your purpose, and the magic inside you. The Emerald Spiral is a free event with free parking at the Kent Commons building, which is 525 4th Avenue North, on Saturday, on July 24, 2021. And the hours are 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. So if you want to learn more and you want to get a booth from Astara Brisky is a lady who's running this, and you can call her or contact her at emeraldspiral.com.
I'm Gary Mance.
I'm Suzanne Mitchell.
We're a couple of baby boomers who bring you a talk radio mix of metaphysics and music, politics, and pop culture.
And you never know which celebrity will join us for an interesting conversation.
Mance and Mitchell is Boomer HQ, Friday and Saturday mornings at 10 on 1150 AM KKNW.
Your home for alternative talk in Seattle and Western Washington.
Be sure to support the sponsors of your favorite shows on Alternative Talk 1150.
Oh, man, it just gets better, doesn't it? Wow. Michael, that is beautiful. And I've heard that before. That's a familiar theme. That's a French horn, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I thought.
And that wonderfully plaintive theme in the French horn.
Oh, man, that would be the hardest thing to play, I bet. To control
one
it.
One just loves the horn, though. Oh, it's so beautiful.
Oh, it's wonderful.
In those contexts.
I love the mellow instruments so much, like cello, you know, that kind of stuff. So, that's an interesting piece. Now, what was the story behind that? It's a beautiful French title, but Pavane for a Dead Princess?
Well, it's like I think it's a funeral cortege, basically.
Oh, you know, okay. All right.
I'd have to double check, but I think
Well, that makes sense. It does sort of sound like a bit of dirge-y.
Yeah.
Okay. You never know. Okay. That's the interesting thing.
The interesting thing is that he wrote that piano piece in 1899 at the age of 24, but he didn't orchestrate it until age 35, and that's when sat up and took notice and said, oh my goodness, this is such a beautiful piece.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I'd have to study that myself about the first quarter square after the Saturn return. That's interesting because that seems to me, it sort of means you've done your homework and you do it again and then something happens, right? Yeah.
Well, often, I mean, you probably consulted many more people than I have, but what I find is that certain individuals, when the Saturn return comes, it isn't as if there's a huge upheaval in their lives or there isn't a huge recognition. It waits that extra 7 years. And then, I mean, I can speak from personal experience. That's when my life blew up in a very interesting way. It was at my Saturn square.
Saturn always delays.
So these types of individuals, it seems that they, maybe all of the structure is established by the Saturn return, but the, you know, the true manifestation of what that structure implies takes that bit longer.
Yes, it takes a little, like 7.5 years longer for it to kind of show up.
You know,
well, that makes
you know, maybe with someone as watery as Ravel, it's the essentially inchoate nature of his creative thought that just required that much longer to sort of find its framework. You know?
I mean, that makes sense because
He
was not like everybody else, people, you know, and he probably flowed a lot, but he also moved through things quickly because of the Uranus in his chart being so prominent. Yeah. And basically kind of what he got known for was this real wacky side of him, you know, that kind of stood up to different authority figures and said, sorry, I'm not doing that, you know. So it's interesting, but to hear, it comes out in the music, obviously.
Yeah.
Music is so Piscean, it's unbelievable. So it's,
well, in a weird way, when you just said that, I was reminded of Dickens' Uriah Heep, who basically said at one point, I would prefer not to. I think that's the Ravel mantra. It's like people said, oh, you should do this, you should do that. He'd say, well, I'm just going to do my own thing.
I don't think
I'd rather not do that. You know?
Yeah.
And there's an interesting little song that he set by a poet named Tristan Klingsor, which is called, of all things, L'Indifférent, which means the indifferent one.
Oh.
And it has a sort of ambiguous sexuality in it, which...
Very much him, too.
Yeah, which is very much him, but it's that same idea, is that he sort of sees this enigmatic sexual figure in a doorway, and they're sort of just passing through, and he asks them to stay, but they say, no, I'm not. And you can sort of see Ravel reflected in that whole ethos, you know, throughout his entire life.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I was kind of reading through the section on his personal life, and there was this little teeny paragraph, not much there. You know,
no, when you compare it to other individuals, you know,
no, he didn't show it, you know, and if he did, you know, it was very private, very tucked away. Nobody knew who he was, you know.
No.
Yeah. And I mean, we could say that's the Pisces for sure. I mean, not really knowing somebody, probably because he wasn't sure if he knew himself that well. But, you know,
could be.
That could be a possibility. But
OK,
let's move on to the point where he has his accident, because this is serious, and it changed the course of his life. And I want to talk a little bit about some possibilities with that. So it was October 10th, 1932. I didn't get a time, but I did the chart around it, and sure enough,
me too.
See, we're so good. You know,
we're nothing if not thorough.
That's right. I have a Virgo moon. What can I say? So,
and you know what? I've gotten Virgo. So
that's right. Yes, we do. So, okay. And the thing that I noticed, of course, of the most was Mars right smack on his Uranus. I mean, you know, and it was a head injury, which, you know, Mars rules the head. So this thing happened all of a sudden, bing, bang, boom, it was done. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, how this affected him. It was pretty
interesting.
Pretty,
of course, he wasn't driving. He was in a taxi, right? So
so he wasn't driving either. So he wasn't even in control. Okay.
No, it was a passive victim. And apparently it was just a minor bump on the head. But what it seemed to do, as I know you probably read, is it seemed to exacerbate sort of pre-existing tendencies toward a certain mental, lack of mental clarity.
Yeah.
And over time, of course, it developed into full-blown aphasia. You know, where
that's right.
No longer, even though he could still think in musical terms, and he could still recognize certain musical things, like he could recognize that a friend's piano was out of tune, for example, he could no longer write music.
Yeah, right. Completely, and he couldn't even hear music either. He It was so tragic. It was. It kind of reminded me of Beethoven losing his hearing.
Yeah, similar idea.
Yeah, something like that, you know, where he had it for a while, it was wonderful, but then, you know, boom, it's gone. And the thing that I was kind of thinking about was that, and I don't know why I was thinking about this, but, you know, the fact that he got this head wound, and then literally it just dovetailed, went downhill from there, where he just completely, you know, lost, you know, all perception, and, you know, he couldn't, you know, his brain wasn't working right. Now, admittedly, this isn't as much as a football player would get, but I mean, a football player would get way more than that. But I'm thinking it was about CTE. You know, I don't know why that came out, but that one injury It's like having it, and it wasn't a big blow, but it probably hit a certain part of his head that wasn't a good place to hit, you know,
yeah.
And it kind of dovetailed into everything else, sort of like CTE does in football players,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I'm not recognizing the acronym. What is it?
What's
CTE,
that?
CTE, you said? What's the acronym you're using, CTE?
CTE. Yeah, oh, do you know what that is?
No, I know about traumatic brain injury, TBI, but not
okay.
CTE.
CTE is a condition that is discovered in football players after they've played for years and years that basically disintegrates the brain. And from all the hits that they get on their head. You know, like Aaron Hernandez, who was very violent and killed people, had CTE worse than anybody that he'd ever seen. You can't see it until after the person's died. They have to do an autopsy to see it.
And it stands for chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
Encephalopathy.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, okay. So, I mean, that's, and I've read about a lot of different particular very powerful football players that have, that really need the security of being taken care of by the NFL once they get older, because their brains start to go crazy, you know, because of all the blows they've taken on their head. So, and this is a recent situation, but it's very, very serious. So this sort of reminded me of that, even though he had one blow, you know, and it wasn't even that bad, it must have hit something fairly critical in his mind, because everything else seemed to kind of fall apart when that happened.
Yeah. Apropos of this, from an astrological perspective, in addition to the transiting conjunction of Mars with natal Uranus, we have the transiting Mars Uranus midpoint 16 Gemini, which is square his Sun Moon conjunction.
Ooh.
And I note further that, of course, if you look at his sixth house natally, he's got Chiron in what sign? Aries.
Okay.
Right, with Neptune. So that, in many ways, that I think that describes the whole nature of the of the health crisis that ensued. He has a head injury.
That's
and then
sense.
Dissolving aspect of Neptune.
Yeah, it's something else I'm noticing here. I did a bi wheel, and the North Node is in 15 Pisces, going right over his Sun Moon combination.
Yep.
North Node. Yep. I mean, that's literally okay. We're going to change and go this direction. The whole change in persona and everything.
Yeah,
you know?
The nodal axes in both charts are activated very strongly. You know,
very strong.
You have transiting Uranus at 21 Aries, and you know, it's conjunct his natal Chiron and his natal North Node. So there's all these replications of these implications, you know, of injury to the head.
Which would explain how almost all parts of his brain seem to just kind of go tilt at once, you know. And it's really sad because he was actually he kind of knew what was going on, kind of, you know, but he wasn't able to do anything about it type of thing. He was still conscious and he was in relatively good shape. But he had to die with this stuff in his head, and he knew what was going on, you know? So that's...
Yeah, I found an interesting article by a gentleman named Richard E. Sederwitz, and he wrote a great deal about synesthesia. Now, I was under the impression that Revelle was someone who had synesthesia, but I've since come across sources that said no. But he did write a very interesting article about Revelle's aphasia, and he said, in spite of the aphasia, he said, Revelle recognized tunes easily, especially his own compositions.
Right.
And could readily point out errors of incorrect notes or rhythm.
And
as I mentioned earlier, he could understand that a friend's piano was out of tune, but he just simply couldn't bring the music forth as notation.
Right, right.
He could probably still hear it in his head, as you pointed
out. So it actually affected the left side of his brain, right?
Yeah, it would seem so.
Yeah. You know, the analytical part where he couldn't really write anything down. But the right side of the brain was seemingly okay. Oh, interesting. Okay. That just makes sense. You know, it makes more sense when we talk about it. Because I was reading this. You know, how am I putting this all together? You know, I'm looking at the astrology. I'm seeing some of the things that are happening. Which, you know, and also he had Saturn going over Venus, too. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
He had that, too.
Yeah.
Oh. That would have been like a doorstop put right there real quick. Yeah, that would have been tough. So Anyway, we have to take another break really quick. And when we get back, we'll be finishing up with Mr. Maurice Ravel. This is the Jupiter Rising Show right here on KKNW Alternative Talk Radio. And this is a live read for Susan Bergstrom of the Medicare Exchange. Susan Bergstrom is a licensed agent in Washington and Oregon, helping people obtain security in their lives and providing insurance that pays for final expenses and money for transitioning after a loved one dies. Now, there's a new long-term health care tax here in Washington State. It's starting in January 2022. It is going to be imposed on everyone that is a W-2 employee. That's most everybody except for people on Medicare and, you know, that kind of stuff. So, or self-employed. This is a new state tax. You'll be forced to pay 71 cents for every $100 you earn. So if you earn $200,000 per year gross, the state will take $1,160 per year in additional taxes from you. The benefit will give you $100 per day for 1 year. If you still live in Washington, to qualify, you must pay in for 10 years, and even after that, you don't get any money. So I can, she says she can provide a personal long-term health care policy with much better benefits if you want to opt out of the state's plan. The state has made tax mandatory. You cannot opt out unless you pay for your own. There's a bunch of rules on how the policy must be structured. Please call me if you want a cheaper option. Most life insurance contracts with long-term health care writers do not meet the criteria. It is worth a conversation. So if you want to talk to her, call her at Susan Bergstrom at the Medicare Exchange, and her number is 253-318-9379, and you can contact her at sbergstrom@americanseniorbenefits.com, and we're going to be at the Emerald Fair next week. She and I are sharing a booth, booth number 36, so come and see her and talk to her at that time.
Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/1150KKNW.
You know, that's very different from him. It seems like it reminds me wandering through a forest, dark at night. Yeah. You're seeing all these things flying around and bugs around and animals around. That's what it reminds me of. But
right.
So
that's Laval's.
Laval's, that's correct. Yeah.
Which is sort of a, how would you describe it? It's sort of a postmodern, I mean, this is obviously long before postmodernism, but sort of a deconstruction of the Viennese waltz.
Really? Whoa.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like he's playing.
Yeah, again, and he proposed it as a ballet to Diaghilev, who said, no, he said it's a magnificent work, but it's not a ballet, although it was subsequently staged by other people. And, you know, it's a very interesting work. So we haven't listened to Bolero, I agree.
It's coming up at the end.
Okay.
We're saving the best for, we fear, everybody else is probably going, well, where's Bolero? I said, it's going to end the show today. And I figure that's a good place to put it, you know, because we play a little bit of it that for there, you know. So, yes, I know. I just wanted to leave it as a surprise.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to spoil the surprise.
That's okay. I thought you might be wondering about that, too. But it's going to see us out today, so...
go ahead.
Anyway, so this is interesting because when was this composed? What part of his life? Was it at the end of his life that he composed
it? At 45 in 1920. So.
Oh, okay.
You know, after his involvement in the First World War, which was an interesting thing, I think, for him.
Yeah, it was.
Although many of the composers that were alive at that time, you know, would have readily signed up, but he was a bit on the old side.
He was a lorry driver.
Yeah, lorry driver. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they wanted to give him the Legion d'Honneur for his participation. He said, no, I don't want it.
Right.
You know? Yeah. But yeah, so, and after the death of his mother, of course, which hit him very hard.
Yeah. I mean, it was just, you know, he was starting to gain some popularity through the 20s too, but
yeah. In 1928, he did a 4-month tour of North America, as you probably know.
Yes, he did.
That was really the apex of his international popularity while he was alive.
Yeah. Do we know what cities he came to?
Chiron return. Go ahead.
Do you know what cities did he come to in the United States?
Oh, can't remember.
Okay.
Quite a few of them.
Just curious. Yeah. That would have been a real, that would have been tough on him because of his physical stuff that was going on. It seems
like he did. There was an All Revel program that Serge Koussevitzky, very famous for his championship of works by young composers, did in New York, and Revel got a standing ovation at a concert in New York.
Remember
and he said things. Here, and you probably saw this, he said, well, you know, this sort of thing just doesn't happen to me in Paris.
Right, right.
He went to Niagara Falls, apparently, and the Grand Canyon, but again, remained profoundly unmoved by this development. It's like he said, this reason to claim is no more important than the earlier condemnation that I received.
Right, exactly. Now, when it comes down to Polero, because everybody knows this, what year was this composed? This was, I can't remember. I wrote it down here. Last composition of the 20s. Oh, did it at the end of the 20s. Okay.
Yeah, 1928,
okay,
more
right,
or less
right.
Simultaneous with that tour. Again, interestingly, after his Chiron return, he achieves the apex of his fame.
You know,
of course, we could argue maybe that's because Chiron's sitting right on the North Node.
Oh, well, no wonder. Yeah, that's like really brought that to fore. Okay, so it was an interesting piece because he actually said at one point, I wrote one masterpiece. Unfortunately, there's no music in it. I just thought that was so funny. So, I mean, and it was his most famous piece, you know. People loved that piece, you know.
Yeah.
And
Eileen, have you ever heard Frank Zappa's cover of it?
Oh, no, I haven't. I've missed that one. That should be interesting.
You should listen to it. It's really great.
Oh, I bet. Now, I heard some sort of story that when it was first played somewhere, that when the people were listening to it, they were sitting listening to it, and they got progressively more agitated as the music got further into the piece. You know, because if in case he didn't know this, but I mean, this could be his sexuality that was kind of way on the back burner, you know, with Scorpio rising too, you just never know. But, you know, that piece is just one big sexual act, as far as I'm concerned. That's what I heard.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, no, you could certainly argue. He said it was one big crescendo.
Yeah,
sure.
Crescendo. And that's typically with sex. That's the way it is. And at the end, there's a big climax, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so that's what I kept thinking when I heard it. And, of course, you know, Bol Derek made really good use of that piece during her movie 10. You know, that's really brought it to popularity. But it's like when I listen to it, I sit there and I get more and more tense. Listen to it, you know, it's just getting more tense. I can't stand it. I wish it would release. And then when chords actually release, and you go, oh, thank God, you know, you know, now I can breathe again. You know, it really was like that for the first time I heard it. The whole thing, you know, 17 minutes worth of interesting. He said it was 17 minutes worth of something. It was something like just nothing, or, you know, no music at all. But
Well, apparently the premiere, some old woman stood up and shouted rubbish. And he said, yep, well, she got the message.
So,
well, speaking as a musician, I would maybe argue that it's an early example of a certain type of musical development, but it's really textural modulation rather than thematic.
Yeah.
You know, modulation or thematic.
Exactly. He said it was very technical and sort of non-music, you know, and it really is just repeating themes all the way through it, but it's quite musical, actually. I think it's quite lovely, but his perspective of it was like, well, something I did, I had to write it for something. He had a commission to write that. So, I don't know. Maybe he was just kind of on a tape loop the whole time. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, makes sense. I have 3 minutes. Oh, thank you.
Okay.
So, yes, he just did three at me. Okay. So we need to kind of, you know, close this one down today. This was really good, though. Such an interesting topic. You know, he was one of
I'm glad I was able to introduce you to some of his really marvelous
thank you,
pieces.
Because that's so beautiful. All of it is beautiful. Yeah. I just love the tonality of it. But, I mean, I'm actually turning into, with a Neptune going over my sun. For the last, 6 months, I've been enjoying music way more than I ever have before, you know, especially classical music. So It just makes perfect sense. So thank you so much for being on our show today, as usual. And
no, it was a delight, Eileen.
Well, thank you. And another 6 weeks, we'll have you on doing somebody else. We'll figure that out in the meantime.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you so much. Appreciate
it. Okay, Eileen. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Talk to you soon.
Okay. So, all right. So we're going to do the upcoming events. 2 minutes. Oh, God. I got to hurry up. Okay. We have the Readings After Dark, which is Monday night at Pizza Casa in Lakewood. That's 12924 Pacific Highway Southwest, 98499, and it's at 4 o'clock. We start there and go to about 6. Okay, and then we also have the new Jupiter Experience, a metaphysical conversation. It's a psychic group starting in Lakewood beginning on August 3rd at Pizza Casa, and we will have Donna Sebo speaking at the very first one. And also, I do the horoscope column on the KKNW's website every week. We change that. It's weekly horoscope. And also, I have a couple of items on Barrel Full of Monkeys, those two audio books I read too. Well, 1 minute. Okay. So anyway, so you can get a hold of me at EileenGrimes.com and JupiterRising.com at AOL.com. And Michelangelo, what's your email address or your address?
Email address, planetaryvibrationalmedicine@gmail.com.
Thank you very much. Okay. So, and next week we will not be here because it's going to be the Emerald Spiral. But the following week we're having on Susan Bergstrom. She's going to be talking about the Medicare stuff that's going on right now. And we're going to end this show with Bolero. Have a good week, everybody.